The end of the last class, Yisrael mentioned about Rav Messas and Rav Avadi Yosef. So let me point out one more thing that I didn't say last week. It came to issues of Mamzerut. Rav Avadi would turn to Rav Messas, and there's many responses of Rav Messas, and then Rav Avadi just gives his approbation. In fact, Rav Avadi says, the Pasuk, Vizar HaShemesh Uvah HaShemesh. Shemesh is, equals Messas, Mashash. That's what he said with regard to Rav Messas. And there are, I mentioned one dispute. There's other disputes also. We're not going to go into it because today we're moving into Rav Avram Shapiro. But another famous one is that according to Rav Avadi Yosef, a Sephardi could eat in a restaurant in which non-Jews are cooking the food as long as a Jew has lit the fire. The same approach for the Ashkenazi. Now, if according to the classic approach of the Shulchan Aruch, you need to have the Jew do the entire cooking, in which case I don't know if there's any restaurants in America that Israelis could eat at, but Rav Avadia, I mean, that the Sephardim could eat at. But Rav Avadia says that, no, he says it's sveksveka, and you could. And Rav Shlomo Messas says absolutely not, you can't use a sveksveka against the Shulchan Aruch. A sveksveka is a double doubt. Maybe the halakha is not in accord with the Shulchan Aruch, and maybe if it is in accord with the Shulchan Aruch, these particular meats do not have any of the adhesions that make it a problem. I've been meaning to get to this for many weeks since last semester, so let me just say it. One of you wanted to know about Rav Yosef Kafach and how he worked as a dayan, if he had like the Rambam. I answered this, but I'll answer it again. And I believe a new little booklet just came out of Rav Kafach's response, a short response that he deals with it as well. But it's in his commentary in the Mishnah Torah, for those who want to check it. It's page 278. And he says that today we have to pay people to work as rabbis because eight lawsuits. If we don't, then we won't have people who will do it and Torah will be lost. And I'm assuming that's the justification he gave himself. Okay, moving on. I was asked last week when we discussed the Shadal dispute, what about the Gemara speaks about, even the Mishnah speaks about, it's the Mishnah and Shabbos that women would wear shadels, would wear wigs and walk outside. And it was a question, you know, over there, if it's can you do it on Shabbos? So how could Rav Avadia therefore come around and say you can't wear shadels? What I mentioned last time was correct, but I checked on this. It's Yabi Omer, Volume 5, number 279. Exactly what I recalled. First of all, he said that those wigs are dealing with where you had something on top of it. A shawl or something like that. And he also says that only the women who had no hair would go out with it, so he deals with it. One more thing I was asked about, I mentioned that Rav Messas testifies that they didn't make brachos, they didn't do anything in Morocco with the women, and I'm going to tell you an interesting story about that in a minute. How did that jive then with what I said, that he ruled that women could make a bracha, a mitzvah say shazman grama, a positive time on commandments. He actually deals with that very question in Shemeshumagin, Volume 2, number 72. And he was asked this question by a rabbi, what the Moroccan custom is for women making brachas on things like lulav. And he said, there is no custom because they didn't know anything. They didn't make any brachas. But then he continues explaining, but if they want to make it now in Israel, it's quite appropriate and quite proper. One or two more things here. With regards to the women's prayer thing, I don't want to get into it in too much detail, but don't think that women didn't pray before modern times. They did pray, and they prayed in Yiddish and other languages. And Daniel Sperber, in his book Minhagei Yisrael, has a whole chapter in Volume 7 describing women's prayer groups, actually, if you want to use the modern term, women's synagogues, and all sorts of things that women did. Having said that, I think it's obvious that the traditional woman in Eastern Europe did not pray, had no interest in praying. She was busy doing other things. They said that's why the Magen Avraham has his idea that they make a little prayer every day. Whether they benched or not, I had a little discussion with Barak about this. I still have to check the Chavetz Chaim, his exact wording of the Chavetz Chaim's son. But I'm assuming that the typical woman in Eastern Europe, just like she didn't bench, just like she didn't daven, she didn't bench either. She didn't know any Hebrew. She didn't know Alam Yechiyah by heart. She could make her own private prayer. if she wanted to, thanking God for the food. But that's my assumption, and I don't have time to go into it now, explain why I think that. But as I said last class, if the wives of these great gadolim in Morocco didn't bench and didn't daven, why should we assume that women who go to Beis Yaakov, who know how to bench, when the Chafetz Chaim's wife sat next to her husband when he benched, and that's what the typical woman did, I think that's how we have to assume that most women didn't know Hebrew and didn't. This wasn't what their lives were structured around. I want to say one more thing now, watching the clock on Pilagshim, because a number of you emailed me. So let me first clarify this. I did say last class that the difference between a Pelegesh and a wife was that a wife has a ketubah and also kiddushin, and that's what's found in Talmudic sources. But there are other sources that give different opinions. According to one opinion, the concubine also received a ketubah. And there are even sources, I don't think in the Gemara, but in Sifrei, that the concubine received kiddushin also. So does the concubine need a get? Most people assume she doesn't need a get. Rebecca Vinden states this explicitly. But with regard to the Pilagshim, there might have been some misunderstandings based on the emails I got, so let me clarify my point again. I think it would be a big mistake. I think it would destroy the marriage ideal. It would create all sorts of problems in our communities with children, and it would just be a mistake. What I objected to, what I said last class, was using the language of evangelical family values and turning this whole issue into a moral question. When you speak of it being immoral to live together without marriage, like in the situation of Pilagshim, what I said was that this is degrading to the Ramban and the Raivad, because the Ramban and the Raivad were not immoral. And if they advocated something, ipso facto, in my mind, it's not immoral. Now, you can say that in today's day and age, it isn't acceptable. But that's not the same thing as you hear these people, these Orthodox polemicists and others, who cast it as an absolute issue of morality. Now, I know that you can challenge me, and you can say that, well, morality develops, and things that the Rishonim felt were okay, we regard as immoral, and we're not going to say, well, it just isn't good for this era, like take slavery, for example. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to say that slavery is not immoral, owning other people. Yes, but the Rishonim didn't see it as immoral, so that would contradict me. But I think it's different, because I think with slavery, we have a universal agreement. There's been development of certain ideas. You can see this as Rav Kook and others did, as some sort of continuing type of revelation. But with regard to the idea of Pilagshim and things of that nature, look around the world. Maybe 40 years ago you could have said that, but most of the world doesn't accept this, and they see nothing wrong with it. So I don't think you can speak of it as some sort of natural law, as some sort of obvious morality. Yes, I do believe it would be a mistake, and many of our people would regard it as giving an imprimatur to what is regarded as improper. And that's enough of a reason not to permit it. And you could even say that I don't even want to go and say that if we lived in a completely Torah society, we wouldn't have these issues and we'd see Pilagshim as fine. I don't think that's it at all, because halakha works this way, by being influenced by the outside. But I do not believe this is an issue of absolute morality. And therefore, in this case, especially when we see changing views of morality to make this into some sort of evangelical family values type of thing, I think it casts aspersions on the viewpoint of what was the majority of the medieval authorities, the majority of Rishonim. So again, improper to do it today, doesn't work in our situation, yes, but as some sort of absolute ideal that's always improper and it's immoral and all this, I don't think it's a question of morality. I think it's a question of halacha. Lots of things that the outside world sees are okay, we see as against halacha. And we don't need to use these arguments. I think it turns a lot of people off, because they can look around and they can see that these people are not immoral. They just have a different perspective. Okay, I see it's 9:10, so I want to move on to the subject of the talk, although I have a number of other important things. I will try, God willing, next week, maybe if I've spent 20 minutes, because a number of you have asked me questions, and I want to get to them, including something amazing about fasting on the fast days, and something from this book that just came out. But we need to move on. And in fact, I'm going to start with a story. A story that's really relevant to Rav Avram Shapiro, who we're going to deal with, but it's also relevant to Rav Shoah Messas. It's the figure of the story is Dr. Erica Brown. Some of you might know her, one of the top women scholars in modern orthodoxy. Lives in Maryland, in Silver Spring, Maryland. She just won an award, by the way, a huge education award. She's the scholar in residence in the Washington, D.C. Federation. And this is her story, which she told me. I'm sure she told other people. She went to Bravender's at the time that it was in Kiryat Moshe, if you remember that. And she would go to Merkaz Harav Yeshiva to daven mincha. And if you know what Merkaz is, the men daven up, the women's gallery is upstairs. It's a big room with a women's gallery. But the problem was, during the week, the guys are upstairs learning. So she would come into the women's section, and it would get them very annoyed because they would have to leave and go downstairs. One day she comes in for mincha, and one of the gvachrim there tells her that, passes her a note that Rav Avram Shapiro, who at the time was the Rosh Yeshiva, and Chief Rabbi of Israel, wants to see her. So she goes to see him, she knocks on the door, and his wife answers, and well, the first thing his wife says is Rav Avram doesn't speak to women. But Rav Avram was in the background, and he said, let her in, she should come in. And he told her that he heard what's been going on. The Bachrim have complained that she's coming up there. And so Erica Brown explains that, you know, she wants to go there, daven mincha. And Rav Avram looks at her and says, and I know maybe the women will take offense at this, he says, are you a balas tshuva? Now, what did that mean? And this relates back to Rav Mesas a bit, because in the traditional frum world, the idea that a woman would go daven mincha with a minyan, to daven mincha at all, was just unheard of. Certainly to go daven with a minyan. I mean, this isn't the thing that in the Haredi world or even the frum religious Zionist world women do. This is something that they do in the more modern Orthodox world, and maybe it's even a good thing. After all, the Shulchan Aruch is supposed to daven mincha. But the fact is they didn't, and they never have, and they don't today. So I think that question says a lot about the traditional viewpoint. And what they did, the end of the story, was they set up a special little corner with a mechitza so the guys did not have to go down, and she could daven mincha. Now, whether this fits into Rav Avram's overall Weltanschauung, we can reflect a bit later on when we speak about some of his ideas, but it does show this conservative, this hesitation about these new ideas, women davening, all these things. And if you want to know the truth, the traditional Orthodox world feels that they have lots of problems, and a lot of from the more liberal Orthodox world, and a lot of these problems began with things very innocuous. Women learning Torah, women davening. But once you open up the door, you know, to women doing these things, then where does it stop? And we'll get back to that in a little while. Today and next class, today is June 15th, we're focusing on Rav Avram Shapiro, late Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel, Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz Harav, very significant person. Some of you will see him significantly in a bad way, that his influence, I guess this depends on whether you liked Obama's speech less in Cairo or not, you'll see him as a positive force or a negative force. I also have to say that he was the last Gadol B'Yisrael, the last universally recognized great sage to hold the position of Chief Rabbi among the Ashkenazim. Among the Sephardim, the Sephardic Rav today is a great sage. He certainly qualifies, but among the Ashkenazim, and I do believe Rabbi Lau was a great man, but no one would really regard him as the upper rung, first rate, in terms of great Torah scholars, and the current Chief Rabbi doesn't even get to the second or third league. Now, for those who want to have a sense of who he was and what he meant to his followers, I can send you a link, or you can go to the Yeshiva Beit El. Listen to the Hespedim for Rav Avram Shapiro when he died last year in Sukkos. You hear people giving Hespedim for him, and the young people there, people in their early 20s, are crying. Now, I haven't been to that many great sages' funerals. I was only at Rabbi Soloveitchik, and no one was crying there. Maybe it's typical to cry at great sages, but usually these great sages are quite elderly. Rav Avram Shapiro was, I think, 93, 94 years old, so and he had been sick for a little while. So it wasn't as if there was a surprise. But when you see the crying, the weeping, it really moves you, and it shows you that this is not just a typical Rosh Hashiva. This is someone who, I mean, when you think of what the Gemara says, that a Rebbe in some ways is more significant than a father, because the father brings you into this world and the Rebbe brings you into the next world. And they're not speaking about a Rebbe, your fourth grade Rebbe. And they're really not even speaking about the Rebbe you have at yeshiva for a couple of years. They're speaking about a Rebbe who is your Rebbe Muvhak, who you've with for many years. That's what they're referring to. Now, I do know that at the Lubavitcher Rebbe's funeral, people cried. No question about that. On the other hand, people were dancing and singing also, because some of them thought that he's going to come pop out of the grave and become the new Rebbe or Mashiach or something like that. But yes, at the Lubavitcher Rebbe's funeral, they obviously thought of him as their father figure. People cried. It's interesting, just because it's in the news, I'll mention it. After the Rebbe passed away, for a good 5-6 years, there was talk about perhaps a new Rebbe. Obviously, there's not going to be a new Rebbe. But two names were often in the news. One was Adin Steinsaltz, who was, to be the Rebbe of Chabad, you need to be a great Talmudic scholar. You also need to know about what they call Nistar, Kabbalah. So Steinsaltz, although he's not really Chabad, I didn't even know he was Chabad, but he has certain Chabad tendencies, he, I guess, could fit the bill. But there was another name. In fact, I only know of one other name that was mentioned, but it wasn't mentioned, I don't believe, from any of the Lubavitchers, but I saw this mentioned a number of times in the general Jewish press. And when I tell you the name, you'll laugh. First of all, the idea that someone who could write books about, people are not modest and things like that to the English audience, when you're a Chabad rabbi, you can't just impress the non-religious. You need to be able to go into Crown Heights and give a Farm Reagan and impress people who literally know Kola Torah, Kula. Chabad has many great Torah scholars. Don't assume that the shliach you see near your house, he's representative of Chabad. Most of them don't know anything. But there are many Chabadniks who are great, great Torah scholars. So the name actually was Manas Friedman from Minnesota. I just mentioned him because we've become accustomed in the last couple of years to literally Yechul Hashem every week. I mean, this week was no exception. Last week was no exception. It's nonstop. And he was the Chilul Hashem of a few weeks ago. I think we had two or three in that week. But just to think that he was the one that he mentioned is incredible. I want to start, as we always do, with the biography. And we're fortunate, Avraham Shapiro, we're fortunate that we have what happened with, well, he was the one that says that if you want to fight against, win the war against the Palestinians, you have to kill all their civilians. Destroy their houses of worship. Kill their cattle. I mean, wipe them out, man, woman, and child. Now, either he's crazy or he's stupid, because if he really believes this, then he has to be, he's crazy if he believes it, but if he doesn't believe it, then he's stupid for saying it. Either way, he's stupid, because if he does believe it, to say this publicly. But it created a huge Chilul Hashem. The Chabad had to come out against him. Agudas Yisrael had to come out against him. I mean, you can't go on, especially Chabad, which is supposed to be so friendly, to talk about killing children and the cattle. What's the problem with the cattle? And destroying their places of worship. That's all we need. Jews talking about how we're going to start killing their children, even if he does believe it. But now that was of 2 weeks ago. Just plug his name into the internet. And, of course, he had to do what people always do in those circumstances, apologize, et cetera, et cetera. I just think it's amazing that someone like him would have been, people don't know anything about Chabad. You think that someone, because they're a shliach, because they could appear on a telephone or on TV, that's what makes a Rebbe? But he was the only name I saw mentioned of the Americans. He was quite popular. I think he was on the Oprah show. He wrote this book, I believe it's Why Don't People Blush Anymore, something like that. And he probably was the most influential Chabad personality. None of them really have a national influence anymore. But he had close to a national influence in Chabad, apparently. That's what they tell me. A book came out 2 years ago, actually 1 year ago. Here it is, Imre Schaefer. All about Rav Avraham Shapiro. The first part is his biography. The second part is comments on Chumash. And the third part is Shmuot, all about stories he told of Gedolim. And I'll speak about that right now. But let me first see what was... Alan, these are not questions that I can answer now. Who wrote this book? Two people wrote this book. One is Yitzhak Dadon. We've mentioned Yitzhak Dadon a few times. We're going to get back to him also. He wrote this book, two volumes, Atchaltehi, as well as other Torah works. He is the man who was learning Torah at the Merkaz Yeshiva when the terrorists came in a year and a half ago on Purim. Right near Purim, and he got up and he took his gun and he shot them and killed them both. So he's a great example of a Torah scholar. He's written a number of Torah books. I think he's about 42 years old now, as well as a worrier. He's the one, by the way, who, if you watch the video after the killing, he was the one yelling at Shimon Peres. But he's one of the authors. He was a Talmud Muvhak of Rav Avraham Shapiro. The other author is named Baruch Rakover. Baruch Rakover edited a number of volumes of Rav Avraham Shiurim. He is also the son of Nachum Rakover. Nachum Rakover published maybe 35 books, one of the great scholars of Mishpat Ivri, Jewish law. Now, I'll tell you, I got this at Beagle Eisen, but I got great nachas reading this book, and I'll tell you why. Whenever you see yourself cited, you feel good. But this, to see yourself cited by one of the great Torah scholars of our time, is much more meaningful. I was reading in the back, it's called Shmuel Motzei Shabbos. Now, one of the things that made Rav Avraham Shapiro significant is that he was an expert on stories of Gedolim. Not only that, he had a sickness. A sickness I have too, if you've been on this class enough, of a great love of books. He had a great library, and he remembered everything he read, and he wanted to read everything. That's not always the case. I don't even know if that's the case with Rav Avadi Yosef, because Rav Avadi Yosef, although he knows everything and reads all the books, I don't know if he wants to read all sorts of books, or if it's just Talmud, Halacha, things like that. Certainly, Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't have this sickness. Professor Halivni commented to me once that the Aruch HaShulchan's library was bigger than Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe he cites the classic works. He doesn't have any great interest in the other works. Now, Rav Avraham doesn't cite all these Achronim when he writes the responsa, but he knew everything. And his stories are exacting. And we'll see some of them. So, and in the Saturday night, what happens is they would go to his house for Mincha and for Shalosh Shodis, and after Shabbos, Gadon and others would record the stories he told them. So, in reading through it on page 266, Rav Shapiro, they called him Rav Avraham. Rav Avraham started speaking about Kanaim. Certain Kanaim, who are not normal. Well, I'm going to get back to that to talk later about his analysis of what's called Frumkeit, of the turn to Chumras. But there's a note here from his son. Now, his son, his name is Ben Sion Shapiro. If you look in Making of a Gadol, there's a number of things cited from Ben Sion Shapiro, and including some from Rav Avraham Shapiro. If you think Rav Avraham Shapiro knows a lot, Ben Sion Shapiro, in terms of stories, knows more, apparently. Nelson Kamenetsky told me that when I came to Israel, he'll take me to Ben Sion Shapiro. Ben Sion Shapiro has also edited some of Rav Kook's writings, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda, I believe. But you have to be prepared to go for a few hours, because he talks nonstop. And on this passage about Kanaim, there's a note from Ben Sion Shapiro to see the work Kitvei Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg, number 3. So that was very nice to see, because just dropped something. Hold up. This is the first book I published. Published in 98, Kitvei Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg. How the book got to Israel, I guess the distributor sent it to Israel. And Simon Gimel that he's pointing to, it's Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg writing to one of his students, and he advises the chief rabbi of England, this is a student in England, not to give a halachic decision about using microphones on Shabbos, no matter what type of microphone, because they're kanaim, they're great kanaim, zealous people who won't acknowledge the truth, even if he was able to prove it. But they're machmir based on their shikol dat, based on their rikshei livan, based on their inherent ideas, not based on sources. And he says, and you can't argue with them. And they're chashudim, they're suspects. Gam al shvichat damim shel makilim, that they'll literally shed the blood of those who are lenient. Basically, Weinberg is describing these fanatics who, if you give an opinion they don't like, they will destroy you. And he's advising the chief rabbi of England not to mess with these people. I'll tell you a little secret now. In this is a sefer which I wanted to be published everywhere. I mean, to be read everywhere. Not only that, this book, if you look on the English side, it says published with the generous assistance of the University of Scranton and its Judaic Studies Institute. The University of Scranton, where I teach, is a Jesuit university. You know, if I was teaching at Holy Cross or something like that, another Catholic university, and I had that on the inside, it could not, I think, be sold in B'nai Brak, where it was sold. But I used to say for a long time that this is the only Sefer, this only traditional Jewish book ever published with Catholic money. Professor Lyman corrected me that Rav Yonasan Eibschitz was, he was able to get the Jesuits in 18th century Prague to contribute to funding a Talmud. So I will, let me take that back and say this is the first traditional Sefer after the Talmud that was ever, in all of history, all of human history, this is the only Sefer other than the Talmud, and don't count the Bibles because they use the Bibles also, this is the only Sefer in history and volume two ever published with Catholic money that is sponsored by a Catholic institution. But since it is a Sefer, on this passage that I just mentioned, it reads in Hebrew, Rabbi Weinberg says, you have to get the approbation, haskamah, of all Gedol Yerushalayim, and I wrote ki, because, three dots, yesh kanayim gedolim, there are great zealots who don't listen to reason and want to, and will destroy you if you're lenient. Now, in the original, there was one word I took out, ki beinehem, because among them, that is, among the sages of Jerusalem, there are great kanaim and people who you don't want to mess with. Now, I put in the three dots. I'm showing that I took out something because this is, I would never do this in an academic work. One day I'll discuss this and publish it. But in the Sefer, it's traditional when you have harsh criticisms against individuals, you take it out. But I'm telling you now so you can put it into your copy. Where I might say Nibeinehem, but it's that word. Who are these people he's talking about? He's talking about the Eda Haredit, the extremists. Okay, that's the first thing. I got nachas on. But then the very next page, and this is what I literally had to stand up. It's such a joy. They're talking about a Saturday night in 1999. The book is published in 1998. And they're listening to Rav Avram's stories. And then it says, and suddenly, Maran, that's Rav Avram, opened up a book that was on his table. Kisvei, the writings of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, and showed me a letter from Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski to Rav Amiel, etc. going on. So to think that this book I published was on the desk and was being studied by Rav Avram Shapiro, as I said, it's a great thrill. Now, it turns out that the guy gets it wrong, Dadon. Saturday night, he forgot what the letter says. He has, the story is as follows. I have a footnote there in this letter about Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski wrote to, the Chazon Ish about who should be chief rabbi, He wrote to the Chazon Ish about who should be chief rabbi of Tel Aviv after, Rav Aronson died, and Rav Soloveitchik was one of the candidates for that position. That's the only time Rav Soloveitchik went to Israel in 1935. And Rav Soloveitchik, see this letter, the way it's published in the letters of the Chazon Ish, they always take out the names, which is crazy, but they, even when it's innocuous, they take out the names. And the Rav always told his students that Rav Chaim Ozer, who writes about how this one person, he should be the chief rabbi, that he was referring to him, Rav Soloveitchik. Now, it turns out that Shlomo Pick of the Bar Ilan Kolel, about 10 years ago, he knows the family, and they showed him the original letter, and the original letter mentions that it was Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, later to become Rosh Shiva, he was Rosh Shiva Panovich, later to move it to Israel. He was the one Rav Chaim Ozer was writing about. But in Dadon's telling, he says that Rabbi Soloveitchik dacha at Hashara, he said that it wasn't him that Rav Chaim Ozer was speaking about. Obviously, his memory played tricks on him after, by the time he got around to writing it. So that was quite interesting, I think. By the way, there's those who can get a copy of this book, if you're interested in the histories of Gedolim, there's so much interesting stuff in here. And you see his realism. He talks about, just to give you an example, so many interesting things here. We spoke about the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim not wanting to condemn the Shabbos violators. He has a whole story here about this, where some other gadol was angry at the Chafetz Chaim. How could you not condemn the Shabbos violators? You know, they go door to door, they go to collect, they work on Shabbos, and the Chafetz Chaim said, well, maybe they need to support themselves. So this Rav said, well, let them go door to door and collect. And the Chafetz Chaim answered, have you already set up doors that they can come get bread for? He says, no, that on the Mishnah Berurah, Hilchos Shabbos, I worked for 6 years, And I don't know what the halakha is about these people who feel that they need to work on Shabbos, how we're supposed to regard them. And then another great story. There's a book that came out, a biography of this Rabbi Shalom Shvadron. He was known as the Magid of Jerusalem. And it tells a story there about Rav Kook and Rav Israel Meltzer and Moshe Mordechai Epstein, that when they came together, each one of them agreed that they would recite a Masechta Baal Peh by heart. And the others would sit there and listen to them. And Rav Zalman did Yevamos, and Moshe Mordechai Epstein did Bevasra, etc., etc. And what does Rav Avram say? This is the most ridiculous thing you can imagine. Tell me, he says, a normal person is able to sit for hours and just listen to someone, by heart to ram off pages? And these gedolim had nothing better to do than just simply recite pages to one another? They didn't have anything they could talk about? So you get a sense of him as a critical reader of all these gedolim stories. Okay, let's talk about the biography. He's born in 1914. The eighth generation families in Jerusalem. First time he leaves the land of Israel is when he comes to America as chief rabbi. His ancestors go back to the Aliyah of the Vilna Gaon, the students of the Vilna Gaon. He began his studies at the Yitz Chaim Yeshiva, where pretty much everyone did, and then onto the Chevron Yeshiva. I mentioned it many times already. All the great Torah scholars in those days studied in the Chevron Yeshiva. The problem the Chevron Yeshiva has is that, as I mentioned, they can't take credit for many of the great sages, not just sages, many of the graduates who came out of it, people like Menachem Elon and so many others. I had a list on one of my Sorin blog posts of important people. If you go on Wikipedia, you have in Hebrew, the entry of Yeshivas Chevron, they have a list of all the people there. Many people didn't even remain Orthodox, Chaim Herzog and others, but he went to Chevron. After the 1929 riots, Chevron moves to Geula, and that's where he was. Now, while in Eitz Chaim, before he went to Chevron, and continuing when he was in Chevron, he becomes very close to Rav Israel Zalman Meltzer. Israel Zalman Meltzer is the Rosh Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, one of the great Torah scholars in the land of Israel, and even in Europe before the land of Israel. He was the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, and a very different outlook on issues of Zionism and other things, a much more moderate, much more centrist than Rav Aaron Cutler. If you look in one of the volumes of Rav Israel Zalman Meltzer's magnum opus, his Eben HaAzel, in the back you have notes from Rav Avram Shapiro and also Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rav Avram, as a young man, also developed a relationship with the Chazon Ish, and he corresponded with him. In fact, one of the famous letters of the Chazon Ish is actually addressed to Rav Avram. You wouldn't know this because letters of the Chazon Ish, they don't mention who they're to. However, Rav Avram published three volumes of his writings. Minchas Avram, it's called, his Torah writings, and in there you have the correspondence. Some of you who know the letters of the Chazon Ish might recall the letter where he says that I don't want to get into a back and forth debate because that never achieves anything. I have my outlook, you have your outlook, you're not going to convince me and I'm not going to convince you. So we had one back and forth with the correspondence. There's no need to go on anymore. That's with Rav Avram Shapiro. Rav Avram Shapiro was one of those who, when he went to speak to the Chazon Ish, would talk to him through a window. When we dealt with the Chazon Ish, I spoke a little bit about his wife and how his wife was, she was a difficult person, put it that way. Chaim Kollwitz, in his book, Achoza Milita, he discusses about her, Chaim Grada. She didn't like the students constantly coming in, that sort of thing. And the Chazon Ish, the whole story of how he got married is fascinating, that the family lied about how old she was, and when he found out, she wasn't old enough even really to have children, apparently. She was at least 10 years older than him, they say. He refused to break the engagement because he didn't want to embarrass her. There's all sorts of stories. It's hard to get a handle of what exactly is true. Was she really that old she couldn't have children, or was she didn't look that good? Whatever the story is, they all assume the same thing, that the Chazon Ish was basically tricked into this shidduch, and in order not to embarrass a Jewish girl, he wouldn't break the engagement. But she was difficult to live with. All the reports talk about this. So the practice was that the students would come, and they would talk to the Chazon Ish through the window. Now, this woman, she was devoted to the Chazon Ish. She worked so he could learn. But the idea that people constantly coming into the house, we know people like that. So they, that wasn't... she didn't want her house to be a train station, day and night, people coming in, and See, Yehuda records how sometimes she would start screaming at the students, "Get out! Why do you come here all hours of the night?" So the Chazon Ish then began a practice where he'd sit by the window. So students would come to the window, and they'd talk and learning with him. Now, there are the typical yeshiva stories told about Rav Avraham in his youth, how devoted he was to Torah study, how even under the chuppah he's talking and learning with those in attendance. I mean, you get these stories about all sorts of people. But we can say about Rav Avraham what we can say about other great figures in another respect, that had he remained in the Haredi world, he would have been regarded by all as, if not the Gadol Hador, as one of the top two or three. In the days that when Rebbe Yashav was not in the Haredi world, he and Rebbe Yashav were basically the same. That really shows you, as I said many times, in the Haredi world, more than how much Torah you have, it's your hashkafa, it's your outlook. Because you can have all the Torah in the world, but you need to have the outlook. That doesn't mean you don't need to have Torah for the Haredi world, but the issue of the proper, what they consider the proper outlook is really more important, and it trumps how much Torah knowledge you have. I'll just tell you that the week that Rav Avraham Shapiro died, there was another Rosh Yeshiva who died, one with a small yeshiva without any influence. I doubt any of you would have heard of him unless you're really in the yeshiva world. Yatei Ne'eman devoted pages and pages to his memory. Rav Avraham Shapiro, whose funeral was attended by thousands and thousands, who literally, as we'll see, changed the face of Torah for much of the Orthodox world, the Rosh Zionist world, they gave him, if I remember correctly, 63 words, and probably about 25 of those words were all about the traffic problems that this caused in Jerusalem. You can see pictures of the funeral. So, I mean, this brings back memories of the Jewish Observer, what they did with their Soloveitchik. It's the great psul, it's the great flaw of the Haredi world. They have many milas, as we say, many qualities, but their great flaw is that they simply are unable to acknowledge greatness outside of their camp. Chabad does. The Hasidim do. But the Lipisha world just can't. Yes, of course Rav Yashav adjusted his shashkafa. No question he adjusted his shashkafa. Unless they're going to say that for the early years of his life he was hiding his true hashkafa. I don't think there's any evidence of that at all. Remember, he was doing something that the Haredim said it was absolutely forbidden to do, and that's be part of the chief rabbinate. The fact that Rav Goren was elected becomes very significant for all of us, because Rav Yashav, when he, even though he left that world, he still kept the notion that it's important to conquer the chief rabbinate. And therefore you have the situation now of the Haredi Dayanim, the whole conversion controversy. That's all because of Rav Yashav, because he believes in being involved. I believe he did change his views, because if you speak to people who knew him then, and you know what type of person he was, and I know people who know him well. I mean, some of you might know Benji Levine, who's his nephew, or Rav Arya Levine's grandson, and others, and they will tell you that it's not the same. He was always an introvert and always interested in learning, but he was not part of that world, the politics of that world. We'll get to him eventually. The other Rosh Hashiva's name was Pachinsky. He is also a son-in-law of Rav Arya Levine. And a huge Sefer Zikaron came out about him last year. The Shabina Rav declared that Rav Avraham will be the next Gadol Hador. He said that, "I don't know what they say in B'nai Brak, but I say he'll be the next Gadol Hador." The Cheskel Sarna declared this publicly in the Chevron Yeshiva. But as I said, that to become the Gadol Hador for the Haredi world as well, you also need to have their Das Torah. In America, things are different, because in America, the religious Zionist world, the modern Orthodox world, looks to Haredi Rabbanim, Haredi Gedolim, Rav Yashav. They see them as great Gedolim. In Israel, it's very different. There's a complete split. In the religious Zionist world, they have no interest. They couldn't care less about what Rav Yashav says. They know he's a great Torah scholar. You don't have Haredi Mechanchim in modern Orthodox religious Zionist schools. They have their Gedolim, the Haredi their Gedolim. The religious Zionists have their Gedolim, but we are much more enmeshed here in America. Now, in 1944, when he's 30 years old, which is quite old, he marries the sister of Rav Shalom Natan Ra'anan. Rav Shalom Natan Ra'anan. Who is Rav Shalom Natan Ra'anan? The son-in-law of Rav Kook. This will determine the future of his life, because now he has a connection to the Kook family, and it's this that brought him into the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva. Otherwise, Rav Avram would have ended up at one of these Haredi yeshivas, like everyone else. The fact that he was now part of the Rav Kook family means that he's going to be brought into the yeshiva. And that has an effect on him, as we'll see. But if you think of who these people were in those days, Rav Yoshev, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Tzitz Eliezer, they all come from the same milieu. It's not the B'nai Brak milieu, it's the Jerusalem milieu, Rav Zalman Meltzer, Rav Tukachinsky, which are much more favorable to the state, to Zionism, to these sorts of things. That's the milieu he comes from. Soon after his marriage, he begins to give classes, shiurim, in Merkatz. It's interesting, seeing that where Rav Avraham later ended up, that he had a strong relationship, a very close relationship with the Briska Rav, Rav Velvo Soloveitchik. Rav Velvo Soloveitchik had close relationships with many people in the more religious Zionist world. Rav Charlap, Rav Velvo would send people when they needed someone they needed a bracha, he'd send them to Rav Charlap, the Talmud Mufalap, Rav Kook. There's a famous picture of Rav Velvo together with Rav Charlap. Now, how did he come to Rav Velvo Soloveitchik? Rav Velvo had his own minyan. For years, he had his own minyan, but he didn't have a kohen. He asked Rav Avraham, who would go to his minyan sometimes, to be his kohen, because they need a kohen. In Israel, you duchen every day. Rav Avraham, and obviously in previous days of the Torah reading, you need a kohen. For 10 years, Rav Avraham Shapiro was the kohen at the Briska Rav's minion. And the Briska Rav's son, Rav Yosef Dov, was also very close to Rav Avram. Now, in this book, Imre Sefer, it quotes a Sefer which claims that the Briska Rav never washed Levim's hands. And he brings this as a proof. He never went to the sink to wash the hands. And he brings this as a proof that a Gadol B'Yisrael doesn't need to go wash the hands of the average Levim. It's not the kavod. It's not the honor of the great sage. And in this book, he says they would actually bring the sink, bring the a pitcher of water and a bowl to the Briska Rav, and he'd wash them there. But this rabbi in his book derives from this that you don't have to at all. He doesn't need to get up and go because he's a great sage of Israel. Rav Avram was asked about this, and he said, absolute nonsense. The Briska Rav would come wash his hands. But then he quotes this story, which is so typical of the Briska Rav, if you know the Briska Rav. He says, another time, Maran told this story, that when it was time for the Tiwas Yadayim of Rav Velvo to the Kohanim, one time a little boy, a young boy, was there among the Kohanim, and he put his hands out for the Briska Rav to wash his hands. And the Briska Rav looked at him and said, Yelad Lechim, a boy, go back to your mother. You know, the Briska Rav is not one, you know, he has to wash hands, so he's going to wash the kohanim. He's not going to start washing children's hands. I don't understand, Dov, what you're saying about kohanim. You'll send it in. Among the other people who used to go to the Briska Rav was Ritzi Yehuda. Ritzi Yehuda Cook would also go to the Briska Rav, especially Shabbos afternoon was a big time to go to the Briska Rav. And Rav Avram told him not to, because there was all sorts of kanaim there. There were all sorts of extremists, fanatics. The Briska Rav himself was an extremist, but he was able to be an extremist in ideology, but still be respectful for the others. But he had around him all sorts of extremists who didn't make this distinction. And Rav Yehuda Cook would go there, and people would make negative comments about his father, Rav Cook, and it would create all sorts of controversy. In fact, they tell the story here of how it happened that Rav Svi Yehuda stopped going. Rav Avraham and others were trying to get Rav Avraham to get Rav Svi Yehuda to stop going to the Briska Rav, and he says that it's okay, I can handle, you know, these fanatics, but it's great Torah, I don't want to miss the Torah. So finally, Rav Aryeh Levin says to him, that you must stop going. And Rav Yehuda says, no, I have to go. There's great Torah there. And Rav Aryeh Levin says to him, you must stop going. It's not respectful. And that's what stopped him going. Rav Aryeh Levin continued to go. But Rav Yehuda, basically, he was prevailed upon not to continue going to the Briska Rav. In 1956, Rav Avram was appointed a dayan. And there's a funny story of how this came about. Rav Yoshev actually brought him in to be the dayan. he came to him and said that, you know, they need a new Dayan, and so he agreed. The problem was that they were going to appoint this Rav Jolty, and Rav Jolty, if you remember him, he was a redhead. And it turns out there's a long story here. Rav Yashiv had to convince him that he could still learn and he could be appointed. But they were going to appoint Rav Yashiv, Rav Jolty, who was a redhead, and Rav Yashiv's mother was afraid of redheads, gingies. It's a bad sign, and therefore he wanted Rav Avram to be the dayan. And it turns out that Rav Avram was not appointed dayan immediately, but right after Rav Bezalel Jolty. In 1974, he's appointed to the Beis Din HaGadol, the Supreme Rabbinic Court in Israel. Before he was appointed to the Beis Din HaGadol, he is actually one of the Dayanim who supported Rav Gorin in the Langer dispute, and he published an anonymous article in support, and this was not known until I published my booklet on Shaul Lieberman, where we see from Rav Gorin's letter who this person was. Now, in the early 1980s, we spoke about Rav Gorin, and his term as chief rabbi was coming up, and they had to think about a successor. And this was a time when the religious Zionists still controlled it. And Rav Avram was obviously one of the choices. In fact, the two big choices were Rav Shai Yashav Cohen of Haifa and Rav Avram Shapiro. Now, Rav Avram didn't want the position. He said that you don't push out rabbis. But it wasn't up to him. It was up to the government. When it became clear that someone new was going to be elected, he agreed to stand for this. There was also young rabbis who wanted the position. And Rav Avram said, as long as we're going to choose a chief rabbi, it has to be someone who's in the tradition of Talmudic scholar. And he agreed to become chief rabbi. He was the first chief rabbi born in the state of, in the land of Israel. Shortly before this, on Purim, regular Purim, I believe it was, of 1982, Ratzi Yehuda dies. And Rav Avraham is appointed Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav, the flagship yeshiva of the right-wing Gush Emunim, right-wing religious Zionism, to take Ratzi Yehuda's place. So he is now chief rabbi of Israel, Ashkenazi chief rabbi, together with Mordechai Eliyahu, and Rosh Yeshiva of the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva. Now, the significance of his choice as Rosh Yeshiva will only be seen in a few minutes, or maybe not until next week. And it's only going to be seen historically in the next decade. Really in the late 80s through the 1990s, we see the significance of him as chief rabbi. But let me point out one thing now. Who was Ratzi Yehuda Cook? We had three classes on Ratzi Yehuda. Ratzi Yehuda was a spiritual leader. He spoke about faith, emunah. He was more of a Chassidish Rebbe type of person, even though he was a great Torah scholar. But he wasn't the person who was going to give classes in Shas and posting. That wasn't his thing. Rav Avraham was a typical gaon in Jewish law, in Talmud. By picking Rav Avraham Shapiro as the Rosh Yeshiva, and there was another option, as we'll see. This leads to a great split in the yeshiva. But there was another option, Rav Tau, who was much in the mold of Ratzi Yehuda Cook, one who focused, who gave classes on Emunah. They call it Emunah there, not Hashkafa, who was a spiritual type of guide. But by going with Rav Avram Shapiro, Merkaz Harav assumes its place in the classic Lithuanian yeshiva mold where Talmud study and halacha are front and center at the institution. Remember, in the Hasidic world, Talmud study is not central. The Talmudic scholar, the posek, is not central. The Rebbe is central. The Talmudic scholar is a functionary. He's the technician. This was also really the model in Merkaz. You had, when Ratzi Yehuda was alive, he was the most important figure. Not the Rosh Yeshiva, not Rav Avram, not Rav Shaul Yisraeli. Now the yeshiva returns to the classic model, for good or for bad. And for some people it was bad, as we'll see. There were Lithuanian yeshivas where you had this as well. In Sobotka, the altar of Sobotka was the most significant figure, and he was not someone who gave shir in Talmud and Poskim, but it's unusual. Most of the time, it's the Talmudist. Now, Rav Avraham, as I said, in addition to being a gaon in Talmud and Halacha, was a font of information about Gedolim and a good judge of personalities, and he made certain comments which I think you'll find fascinating, observations about the religious world we live in. For example, in one of his Saturday night talks, he dealt with this constant striving for chumrah that you see today. And the fact that people are concerned about things today they weren't concerned in the past. And Rav Avram sees a lot of this as just people are not normal religious personalities. They're concerned about things that are not part of what it means to be a normal religious personality. The following story is told. It happened. A student asked Rav Avram Shapiro if he peels the skin off a melon, or you say an orange, and some of the fruit is also cut off, and then you throw it in the garbage, is that bal tashlis? Is that considered wasting? You know, you have a melon, a cantaloupe, you have some fruit at the bottom there. When you cut it and you throw it out, is that bal tashlis? You know, we can't waste food. People in the, as the story is described, students who were there started laughing at the question. And Rav Avram wasn't laughing at them. He became very serious. And he said firmly, it is forbidden for bachurim, for yeshiva students, to have questions like this. A normal person peels the skin, and that's all. He eats it, and he throws it out. He doesn't ask questions like that. The fact that someone is asking a question like the little bit of fruit at the end of the peel or something, is that bal tashlis, shows he's not normal. He doesn't have a normal religious personality. And that upset Rav Avram very much. And we have other stories about this. It's a sign of, I would say in modern terms, of an obsessive compulsive personality. And even in Yirat Shamayim, even in fear of God, we have obsessive compulsive behavior. Now the Sefer, Imre Sefer, describes this as nervousness. Whenever this book wants to describe, you know, Rav Avram is speaking about these people, he says they're nervous. And it's true that Frumkeit often provides a perfect vehicle for people who have these issues. Because, you know, if you're an obsessive compulsive personality, if you are, quote, have this nervousness to get everything right, what is an obsessive compulsive personality? You know, everything has to be exact, and Frumkeit, you could turn it into something where every second of the day you're worrying about doing this right, doing that right, and we've all seen examples of people like this, including Balei Tshuva especially. We've seen examples of people doing things like that. And Rav Avram says that this is not normal, and the halacha is you have to be normal. So I think this stress on the what he calls nervousness, as leading to chumras, Chaim Rapport has a whole lecture, shiur, on this topic as well, what I think we would call obsessive compulsive, I think that's a very insightful insight. It could be, yeah, I think that's the word he uses here. I don't have the, let me see if I wrote down the page number. Or just nerves. I and Sadi Bet, you're right, you pick it up from the community. It has become normal, perhaps, for the community, but that's why, you know, if you have someone who knows the history and knows and has lived a long life as he did, you get a sense for some of these stories. You have someone in their 90s, and these 20-year-olds are coming up to them and telling them about, well, how do we do this? Or how do we do that? And his added response is, what do you mean, how do you do that? We don't do that. That's not what we do. You know, when someone grew up in the early part of the 20th century among the Gedolim of Israel, of Jerusalem, and grew up that way, he knows the way he saw all these great people live, and this idea that now you're going to start doing new things, from his perspective, that's not normal. Obviously, then after a generation of doing it, it becomes normal. But just his firm response, how he wouldn't laugh, and he says that this is not normal. A normal person doesn't ask questions like that. He's not concerned with these matters. And he even went further. He explained, and I think he's 100% correct on this, that a lot of these chumras, that people come up with these new ideas, they come because people have too much money. He says that if you have lots of money, you can do all sorts of hidurim, all sorts of extra things that no one ever thought of before. Let me see if I can find the exact quote here. Yesha termidai kesef. You have lots of money. We can do all sorts of things. You have people. Now, I have seen Sfarim that tell you, you have to have a second sink. Second sink. You're obligated to have a second sink. Who ever heard of a second sink? They say, if you have enough money, you're obligated to have a second sink. I mean, how could just someone determine that you're obligated to have a second sink? Now, today, lots of people have second sinks, but who ever heard of a second sink? You think people 70 years ago had second sinks? So they're lucky if they had one sink. Who had money? So you have lots of these things now. If you think a lot of these new chumras, they cost money. they're requiring us to pay a lot of money. If you didn't have money, this is the last thing you think of. So you might say, well, maybe this is a good thing, because now we have money, we can strive for a higher level. Rav Avram didn't think so. We'll get back to that maybe later. And I think this fits into the Erica Brown story as well. When you're a conservative person with a small c, changes trouble you. For people like Rav Avraham, traditional Judaism is supposed to be about tradition. So therefore, the idea that you have all these changes, and that it could be changes that some of us think are very good, like girls going to daven with a minyan, what could be wrong with that? But no, that's a change. That's not what people do. They don't do that then. Just like you don't make changes in other areas, you don't make changes here as well. Now, during the Gaza withdrawal, this is in 2005, a great break happens among the students from Tzvi Yehuda Cook. And that's where, as I said, some of you might see Rav Shapiro in a negative way. Some of these students felt that it was forbidden for soldiers to go along with this. They had to refuse orders. And we're going to see Rav Avram's view in a few minutes. But before getting to that, let me tell you about his response to people who are arguing the opposite. The leading figure was Rav Shlomo Aviner. Rav Shlomo Aviner is a major student of Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who was in the Merkaz world, and then breaks with it to a certain extent. And he became famous famously during the Gaza withdrawal. He walked around with his orange ribbon, telling people soldiers cannot oppose the withdrawal, because it's the government of Israel telling them they have to do this. And although the government's wrong, you cannot physically oppose, soldiers need to follow orders. This is known as the Mamachtiyut, the idea that this goes back to Rav Tau, who we'll speak about in a few minutes, the idea that the state of Israel has this holiness, and therefore we can't stand up against it. Even if it's wrong, we have to go along with it. And he developed this idea. If you want to see his ideas, go to the website. There's a website, Aviner, AVINER.net. This website was set up after the Gaza withdrawal for all the people who hate Rav Aviner to take their revenge out against him. They had issues with him before, but this was the chance to destroy him. And on that website, there's a video there from Rav David Bar Chaim. We've spoken about David Bar Chaim a couple classes already. He was the one who I said is a bit of a wild man, but he has a response there to Rav Aviner's position. And you have the letters from Gedolim against Aviner, all sorts of stuff. Rav Avraham came out very strong against Rav Aviner. And not just against Rav Aviner, but against Aviner and his followers. And stated publicly, and even contemptuously, that only those who can paskin questions in mikvot and in agunos and all these questions are worthy of deciding on matters affecting the community as a whole. People like Rav Aviner, who are not deciding questions of halacha and the most difficult matters of aguna, they have no right. They have no standing to tell the Jewish people as a whole what the halacha is in cases such as this. What's ironic here, although he didn't intend this, is I think this would also disqualify Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Because Tzvi Yehuda Cook himself was not regarded as a great posek at all. He wasn't a posek, he never posked, and yet he himself gave decisions on that for the people on a national level. In any event, that's what the Rav Avram said, and it wasn't just directing against Rav Aviner. It's directed against Rav Tau, who we'll speak about in a few minutes, and directed against Rav Yuval Sherlo, all sorts of people like that. Yes, it was just like Rav Bamberger's response to Hirsch. And then you just have to look at Rav Avram's students who took it from there. Now, when Rav Avram took over Merkaz, he had this great dispute, as I said. He was the traditional Rosh Hashiva model. But we saw that Tzvi Yehuda was not. And Tzvi Yehuda had a different student who I met. I didn't know that there was this big controversy going on. But in 1993 or 94, I met Rav Tzvi Tau. Rav Tzvi Tau was the heir in matters of Emunah, Hashkafah. And his many books are written in a fashion like Rav Cook's books. And he was, at the time that Rav Avram Shapiro was the halachic guide, Rav Tzvi Tau was the spiritual guide at Merkaz. Now I see it's already 10 o'clock. What we will do next class, hopefully we'll be able to finish, maybe not, is talk about the great split in the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva, what happened in the religious Zionist world, the creation of the Chardal movement. Chardal is a very significant force in Israel. Rav Avram Shapiro becomes the leader of the Chardal, and religious Zionism really changed permanently under the influence of Tzvi Yehuda Cook and Rav Avram Shapiro, and the great dispute, which leads to the break. And then and then we'll get into more of Rav Avram Shapiro's thought. He has amazing things to say about Das Torah in areas of Halacha, where he takes on Rav Moshe Feinstein and all sorts of interesting stuff. We will pick up next week, the last class of the semester. So before we go, does anyone have any questions or comments? We'll talk about his great psak, the great psak forbidding Israeli soldiers from listening to the government of the State of Israel, which had, as I said, enormous influence. Yes, I will talk about the machlokas, the dispute, because Rav Avram Lichtenstein decides to respond to Rav Avram Shapiro and challenge Rav Avram Shapiro on his psak. So I'll talk about that next class. Well, the point was the story is not true. And how does he know it's not true? For two reasons. First of all, it's boring. And even Gedolim get bored. And second of all, the idea that these Gedolim have nothing better to do than come together. They can't talk and learning. They're rattling off Gemaras. And we see other examples of this. Rav Avram Shapiro would read these books of Gedolim and identify things that he said, these are nonsensical stories. And you have to be an idiot to believe these things. Anyone who reads these genre, I read a lot of it, there's plenty of stories in there which are just impossible. And you got to be really foolish to believe these things. But for me to say it, it's one thing. But when you have, Gadol Yisrael telling, don't believe these things, it's unusual because most Gedolim don't spend their time reading these stories of Gedolim. They spend their time reading the Torah books. But he thought this was part of Torah, understanding great sages. It's an element of Torah. And therefore, he spent a lot of time reading these books. And they would ask him about these books when they visited him, and he would make his comments on them. I'm assuming someone like that did not go to the Sforim source. You know, he's too busy, he's too old. They would bring him the various books, knowing he read them. And I'm assuming that someone brought him the Kisvei Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, and that's how he read it. It would be disrespectful because you had all these Kanoim there who would make comments about his father, about Rav Avram Cook, and they would insult his family. And therefore, in order to spare him this, he wouldn't keep quiet. He would start screaming at them back, and it created a big controversy. So they said that it's forbidden to go there because the people there are degrading you and degrading your father. And that was the issue there. The Brisker Rav always had fanatics who hung out with him. They attracted these types, Naturi Karta, Amram Blau, Ada Haredi types. All sorts of people would come there, people who didn't have respect for other sages. I do not believe that... the Brisker Rav book, I don't know if he's mentioned there. I've seen the book as it's four volumes, I think, or two volumes, or three, I forget. This guy Neller published four volumes of stories of Brisk, and then he published, I think it's two or three volumes of the Brisker Rav. If I'm not mistaken, there's a picture of Avraham together with him, but he might be mentioned in the book. I'm not sure. It's a good question. I don't know. I'm assuming not, because today it's such a different world. They might not... these people, they always cover things up, so I don't know. Rav Herzog is mentioned because there's some famous things. Rav Herzog comes to him to deal with certain halachic matters, but if you read the Hebrew, you see that Rav Herzog is not given the proper kavod, whereas these other rabbis are referred to as Gaon and things like that. Rav Herzog is not referred to that way. So yeah, I don't know if that comes across in the English, but in the Hebrew, you see very clearly the differences. They might have things about Rav Avram Shapiro. I don't know. I mean, he was quite young. I mean, he died. He was 51 when the Brisker Rav died, so he wasn't. It wasn't as if he was a colleague of his. But everyone in the Brisker family, obviously, they. I mean, he was one of the closest people. He was at the Minyan every day for 10 years or something. Yes, he thought that Rav Goren was correct, and was it unanimous? apparently the Dayanim ruled unanimously. That seems to be my recollection. It could be not unanimous, but there was a Beis Din. The Beis Din doesn't need to be unanimous. A Beis Din, I think, of 10 Dayanim, in addition to Rav Gorin, and they ruled. And look, we spoke about the Langer case. You could have had, there was all sorts of reasons you could have been permitted the Langer case if you wanted to. I don't think that if Rishon Lezion and Auerbach came to that conclusion, there would have been such a controversy. But this was just Rav Gorin on top of so many other things. But we know Rav Avram was one of them, you know. Okay, we'll talk about the next class. What you were anticipating is a good thing. Basically, he had many characteristics that he could have been a Rosh Yeshiva and the other yeshivas. We'll get back to that next class. No, I don't think really from Gedalia Nadel. With Gedalia Nadel, what makes him interesting? The fact that he published an unusual sefer? I mean, there are some interesting things about his life, but as we all have interesting things about our life. But he had no influence, and he didn't have any impact. After his death, they came out with a sefer which had interesting things about him. So if we have time and we do a class one day on issues of evolution, things like that, then certainly he needs to be talked about. But do you disagree, David? I mean, you think he has any, most people never heard of him until the Slifkin controversy. So what we're doing next class, I mentioned what we're doing. There's many other figures in the future. There's lots of Gedolim. He doesn't really fit into that model that I really can say much about him. But maybe if we finish with all the top level, we have and then move into maybe the second, we can devote one class to him because he does have some interesting stories. He wanted to join the Israeli army. They wouldn't let him. He was too old during one of the wars. And truthfully, we could speak about his views for a good 45 minutes. His views, not just on evolution. Just to give you an example, he thought that Gezeirah Shavah, he develops this whole idea, was not Misinai. This is just a way that, just like Shaul Lieberman felt, this is just a way the rabbis invented to derive things. And he has all sorts of interesting things in his sefer. But usually for these classes, I do people who we can do, first the biography itself is significant, and then they have influence. But okay, I'll keep it in mind. Yes, Aaron Soloveitchik is a person to discuss. Look, we have a lot. I'll end here by saying next semester we'll do Rav the Ridbaz, Yaakov Dov Golovsky, Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, Rav Eliezer Berkovitz, and Rav Henkin. And I have a whole list of people to do in the future. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik also, he has interesting ideas. So certainly, although his life is not that interesting, it's not like he had one of these interesting lives, unless you want to hear about the split in the Brisk Yeshiva in Chicago and how he gave shiur on the lawn because he didn't accept the fact that they fired him, that sort of thing, or how his machlokas with the Mizrahi when they wanted to sell their building to the Buddhists. But other than those little scandalous type of episodes, it's not like his life is interesting, but his ideas are certainly interesting and trying to join Torah with American society. And Chaim Zimmerman, again, these are all people who are interesting, but they don't have, they don't really have a Weltanschauung, they don't have a comprehensive outlook, they haven't had any influence. Rav Chaim Zimmerman, do you know when Rav Chaim Zimmerman died? Half the people in the world didn't even know, in yeshiva world, didn't even know who he was. They hadn't heard of him. Look, if we finish up the first level figures, we can do the second level figures. I'll wait one more minute if anyone has any other comments or questions. If not, we'll sign off for this week. See you next week, last class of the semester. Good night, everyone.